the decider. That's what Time magazine called Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy in 2012 when they put him on the cover. Justice Kennedy bristles at being called the swing vote. After all of the nine justices' votes are equal. But as the saying goes, some are more equal than others. For the past decade, when the court has been split on an important case, all eyes have turned to Justice Kennedy because he's the guy whose views are toughest to predict. He's also one of the country's most passionate voices on freedom, human dignity, and the power of the United States Constitution.
We're so fortunate. And either by accident or history or providence or design, I think all of those. The self-definition, the self-image of an American relates to his or her Constitution. No other country in the world has that. We can't be smug about this and say no other country in the world can have a Constitution. But this accounts for the fact that our Constitution is the oldest Constitution in the world. I've had the heads of foreign governments ask me, I think I should amend the Constitution to do this and that. Usually something that helps them over the short term. And I say, you know, a constitution by definition is something that has to last over time. Madison said a constitution must acquire the reverence of its people, and it can only acquire that reverence over time. And so the court wants to, is a way, it's one way of reminding Americans, of reminding ourselves that the Constitution must transcend the emotions and the opinions of a particular day. And so the Constitution doesn't belong to a bunch of judges and lawyers. It belongs to you. It's yours.
This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Madam May, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Anthony Kennedy has been vote number 5 in many a recent Supreme Court decision where the votes come down to 5-4, which is to say his views have determined the outcome of some landmark cases, including Obergefell versus Hodges, which in 2015 gave same-sex couples the right to get married, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, which transformed American politics in 2010, by giving corporations and unions the right to spend unlimited money on ads for or against candidates. Then there was Bush v. Gore in 2000, which decided the outcome of the intensely contested presidential race. If you're too young to know what a dimpled Chad is, I suggest you Google it. Reaching back a little farther, in 1992, there was Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which reaffirmed the basic principles of Roe v. Wade, but gave states more leeway in regulating abortion. As I record this episode, all eyes are on Kennedy again, this time in the case of the Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple because of his religious opposition to same-sex marriage. But you're not going to hear Justice Kennedy talk about specific cases in this episode. Justices often decline to discuss cases publicly. What you will hear him talk about in this 2005 interview with the Academy of Achievement is where he came from and how he became one of America's most important public servants. When Justice Anthony Kennedy was a kid, he didn't like school much. He was sometimes so bored he'd just run off and head home to read. To try to keep him challenged, his father, who was a well-known lawyer and lobbyist in Sacramento, his father arranged to get him a job as the first and only page in the California State Legislature.
I think I started in the fourth grade and did it through the eighth grade. It probably stunted my growth because of all the cigar smoke they had in those days. I, as a result, knew Earl Warren very well on a somewhat professional basis. Professional, I was a 9-year-old page boy and he was the governor. But and of course, we knew his children and played in the governor's mansion and so forth. But I have a letter I've given at the Supreme Court Historical Society in which he wrote and said, "You're going to go very far in government."
Earl Warren was a Republican who went from being governor of California to Chief Justice of the United States during one of the Supreme Court's most liberal eras. But back when Anthony Kennedy was a child in the 1940s, Warren was just one of Kennedy's parents' many friends who worked for the state of California.
We had a very vibrant, active household. My father had a rule that my mother always had to set a couple extra places at the dinner table because people would come from out of the city, from out of the state, to see him and consult him. He was a great attorney. And he would bring them home for dinner because he wanted to be with us. And we were taught to stay at the dinner table and to participate in the conversation. So, of course, I guess most people thought, who are these forward, obnoxious little children?
But Kennedy says that he's very grateful for those experiences, those raucous family dinners with such distinguished guests.
The director of public works, the chief counsel for the legislature, the head of the franchise tax board. And these people were very proud to be public servants. And people talk sometimes about the British civil servant of being absolutely committed people of great integrity. This is what those people were like in California when I was growing up. And they had this idea of public service, and looking back now, I suppose that was a formative influence on me. They had this pride that carried down to me, and I'm very proud to be a government servant.
But did he ever want to be anything other than a lawyer? That was one of the questions asked by documentary filmmaker Irv Drasnin during this interview.
Oh, there was really no choice. My dad was an attorney. I think he knew he would not have a long life. He was a solo practitioner. He would take me to his trials in Northern California in these little towns because he was lonely. I'd say, "Oh, I have a geometry test." He said, "I'll teach you whatever you need to know." So I probably saw 10 trials before I was out of high school and took notes at the council table and worked late in his office typing documents. So it was not a question, would you be a doctor or a lawyer or a priest? It was just assumed. I really wanted to be a doctor.
He took a pretty direct route to the life of a distinguished lawyer. Stanford for undergrad with a year at the London School of Economics, followed by Harvard Law. But earlier on, there were a few detours that might surprise you.
In the summer, I got jobs in the oil fields. My uncle was in the oil business. And so at the age of, 14, I got my first job kind of cleaning up around the oil rig. And then I learned how to do that. And I went to Montana, Canada, New Orleans. I worked in a drilling barge on the Gulf in the summer. And you could make a lot of money in those days by the standards of those days in the oil fields. And so I saved that to help for my education. And I loved it. I think I've maybe learned more in the oil fields than I did in the States. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in the working man and the working woman. I think they're very, very concerned with what the country is like, what their life should be like. And I think that taught me a lot.
Some of the other important lessons in Anthony Kennedy's life came, he says, from literature, starting with Dickens and Shakespeare, which his father would read out loud to him when he was a boy.
I think fiction is very important because it gets us into the mind of a person. Hamlet is a tremendous piece of literature. You know that you know Hamlet better than you know most real people. You know the reason? Because you know what he's thinking. And this teaches you that every human has an integrity and an autonomy and a spirituality of his own, of her own. And great literature can teach you that. Billy Budd, Antigone, are very important works. Merchant of Venice, Hamlet, 1984. You and I grew up with great fear of the Soviet military might. And 1984 has one of the most brilliant scenes in literature. The protagonist is being tortured by his communist or totalitarian interrogators. And they want him to say that 2 and 2 is 5. And finally, he can't stand the torture anymore. He says, okay, 2 and 2 is 5. But the torture continues. He said, why are you continuing? He said, the torture continues not until you just say it, but until you believe it. And this is a powerful reminder that governments want to plan your destiny. They want to plan what you think. And this must never happen. And so 1984 is a book of tremendous importance, I think, in that regard.
During this conversation, Justice Kennedy also talked about a lesson he drew from the novel Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe. Wolfe was one of the other honorees that day at the 2005 Academy of Achievement Summit. So Kennedy had Bonfire on his mind as he talked about his life and his achievements.
It's either a parody or a portrayal of New York, probably something, somewhat of both. And he has a hero who's called Sherman McCoy, I think. Yeah, Sherman McCoy. And no one comes out good in this book. The lawyers never do come out very well. Newspaper people don't come out very well. Clergy doesn't come out well. And he's some sort of a businessman. And he goes to the beach with his daughter when she's 9 or 10, takes the day off and takes her to the beach for her birthday. And she looks up and she said, Daddy, what do you do? And he realizes, and the reader realizes, that what he does doesn't make any difference. He manipulates symbols with no ethical content. And if you're going to achieve, you have to achieve by manipulating symbols and working with systems that have an ethical content.
Well, if you're going to achieve and be happy, Kennedy says. And he achieved happiness early. After law school, he took over his father's solo practice in Sacramento when his father passed away. And he began teaching constitutional law at University of the Pacific. Then, when Kennedy was just 38, President Gerald Ford appointed him to the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, making him the youngest federal appellate judge in the country. For a moment, Kennedy hesitated.
I wasn't sure I wanted to be a judge, but some of the people I admired most in the community were judges, and I thought maybe I could best contribute to the law. I love the law. I thought I could best contribute to the law as a judge. I really wanted to be a trial judge. You see real people. You can influence the course of some particular person's life in a way that's more immediate than you can as an appellate judge, which is a writing exercise. If most people could see what an appellate judge does, they would find it very uninteresting. It would be like following the life of a writer. You don't have the excitement of juries and witnesses. But as I said, I wanted to be a trial judge. Watergate had come along. They weren't making new trial judges. And there was an opening on the Court of Appeals. And then Governor Reagan asked if I would like to be considered for that. And I thought, well, you know, the merry-go-round goes around and there's an empty horse. If you don't get on it, the next time it goes around, somebody's on the horse. So I thought maybe I should take this opportunity. And I love the court and I love the law. So
Kennedy loved being on the bench, though in retrospect, he thinks he probably was a little too young to become an appellate judge. He'd been around the courts all his life, but when he stepped into a robe and picked up a gavel, he found the learning curve a bit steep.
It was a more introspective occupation than I had thought. You have to ask yourself, what is it that's making me do this? Why am I deciding this? And it's surprising how often you have to go back to square one and say, you know, all of us have an instinct of judgment that we make. You meet a person. You say, I trust this person. I don't trust this person. I find her interesting. I don't find him interesting. Whatever. You make these quick judgments. That's the way you get through life. And judges do the same thing. And I suppose there's nothing wrong with that if it's just a beginning point. But after you make a judgment, you then must formulate the reason for your judgment into a verbal phrase, into a verbal formula. And then you have to see if that makes sense, if it's logical, if it's fair, if it accords with the law, if it accords with the Constitution, if it accords with your own sense of ethics and morality. And if at any point along this process you think you're wrong, you have to go back and do it all over again. And that's, I think, not unique to the law, in that any prudent person behaves that way. I tell law students that we're not, like some law professors say, teaching you how to think. That sounds a little bit pretentious. Law professors say, oh, we teach you how to think, as if nobody else does. But of course, all good teachers, all good citizens are interested in thinking. It is true that in the law, we teach you to think about very ordinary things in a very formal way. And I had to realize that. The other thing I had to learn was this. Lawyers, judges, law professors talk all the time about stare decisis. If we want to say something important, we use Latin, because then it makes it sound more important. Stare decisis means that you're bound by what previous judges have decided. Unless it's very wrong and very important, and then you have to depart from that precedent, and that's a major event in the law. But essentially, you're bound by stare decisis. When I went on the court, I thought, well, this is not very interesting. It's antiquarian. It's like historical research. I thought I'd be like a scientist putting together an explanation for an experiment that had failed, and I'd go back and say, well, you did this wrong, you did that. And I was interested in it because I love the law. But I thought it was rather limiting. I was quite mistaken. Really, the dynamic of being bound by precedent, the so-called stare decisis, is very forward-looking, because it teaches you that you will be bound by what you do. You're the first person that would be bound by what you do. And if you're on a court which reviews other courts, they will all be bound by what you do. So there is a very forward-looking dynamic to judging. You must ask yourself, to the extent that you can, without being imprecise, how will my judgment play out in the future? And there's a lot of looking out the window in that job. I was in Thailand right after the tsunami. A judges' conference had been scheduled. And I thought, gee, should we be having a judges' conference in the wake of this terrible human tragedy? And the State Department, Secretary Powell was still the Secretary of State, called and said, this is very important. You have to go to Thailand for this judges' conference, because they're talking about what it is to build a society, and you build a society with a legal system. Law is part of the capital infrastructure. We can talk about that later if you want, but going back to Thailand. So we went to Bangkok, I think it was 3.5 weeks after the tsunami. It was 400 miles from where the tragedy had occurred. And the Buddhist people are very quiet and introspective themselves and didn't want to talk much about the specific tragedy. But I talked there with a priest who'd been working with the victims of the tsunami. And he use the method pioneered by the psychologist Robert Coles, who would talk to little children and he'd give them a blank sheet of paper and some crayons and ask the child to draw while they were talking, as if in this interview you were asking me to draw something. And he worked with 10 and 12-year-old, 13-year-old kids who'd lost everything, their brothers, their sisters, their parents, their homes. And he gave that kid four pieces of paper. And the first he said, draw what your life was. Your parents, your brothers, your sisters, your house. And the second was draw the tsunami, because you have to confront evil and the forces of nature which have injured you and somehow come to grips with it. You can't repress this. So draw the tsunami, draw the event. And the fourth paper, of course, was draw what your life wanted, what you'd like your life to be. But the third paper was the hardest, and that's draw the present. Draw the present. These kids had a particularly difficult problem in drawing the present because it was a completely changed environment they had to adjust to. But it occurred to me that maybe it's the hardest for all of us to draw the present. We probably make a mistake when we predict the future, but at least we're confident that we know what it ought to be like, what we want it to be like. And judges have to understand that they have to, in part, deal with the present, and that's almost hard. I can look back and know what the law was. I can look forward and say at least what I think it ought to be. But you must be careful you're not missing something. Your history is moving very quickly, and we're moving with it, and it's hard for us to assess whether or not we're taking the right direction. I don't think our society as a whole does a very good job, frankly, of asking where they're headed.
And how difficult is it, interviewer Irv Drasnan wanted to know, for Kennedy, or any judge for that matter, to transcend his or her personal point of view?
You have to do it again every case. I thought, oh, I'm a good judge now, I know how to do that. And then I'll get a case, and I have to do it all over again. What is it that really should control the decision? What is it that's controlling my decision? And do those two match? Judges, particularly on our court, don't go around giving press conferences. We don't have a press conference saying how great our decision yesterday was or how bad the dissent was or something. Part of the reason for that is that we try to teach a lesson. We try to teach that we will listen to your cause and judge the cause only when we hear it. You know, we in any given year, precluding foreign affairs perhaps, may make more important decisions than the legislative branch does. Important in the sense that it will control the direction of society. This is what, June 3rd, and by June 15th, all of our dissents and opinions must be circulated internally. And by June 30, we will finish our work for the year. 80, 90, 100 cases. And that doesn't mean we're better than the Congress or more committed or more principled. It just means we're different. All we can do is decide. A case is presented to us, and it's our duty and obligation to decide it, whether we want to or not. And we decide it within the language of the law. And the language of the law is different than the languages of the political branches. Not better, not worse, different. It's more confined. The language of the law has a grammar, a logic, a tradition, a dynamic, an elegance, a syntax. It's all of its own. It's the language of the law. It's very formal. And we decide, we are constrained by that language of the law. We can decide only within the confines of that language. Other branches of the government, providentially and happily, have a different language. And the job of the citizen is to translate, and the job of the lawyer is to translate the language of the law to the language of everyday life.
For over a decade, Anthony Kennedy distinguished himself as an appellate judge with a fairly conservative record. And then in 1988, when President Ronald Reagan's first two Supreme Court nominees flamed out, he turned to Anthony Kennedy, his old Sacramento acquaintance, confident he'd be a shoo-in for confirmation. Kennedy was less driven by ideology than the two failed nominees, Robert Bork and Douglas Ginsburg. He had the highest rating from the American Bar Association, and Washington was a much less rancorous place back then. Take a listen to what Reagan said. This was during his last year as president, on the day he announced Kennedy's nomination.
By selecting Anthony M. Kennedy, a superbly qualified judge whose fitness for the High Court has been remarked upon by leaders of the Senate in both parties, I have sought to ensure the success of that effort. I look forward, and I know Judge Kennedy is looking forward, to prompt hearings conducted in the spirit of cooperation and bipartisanship.
The U.S. Senate voted unanimously to confirm Kennedy, and in February of 1988, he took his seat as an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Today, as I record this in 2017, he is 81 years old, and he is the court's longest-serving justice.
Being a judge on the Supreme Court is kind of being like struck by lightning. I mean, the vacancies come up so rarely, and the stars have to be aligned the right way. I like to think that those who were interested in my appointment thought that I was devoted to the law. I like to think that. And that I would be fair. That's all that I ever ask of myself. That's all I ever tried to hold myself out to be. The Supreme Court has these marble steps. Looks like we couldn't have had a Supreme Court if we didn't have Greek architecture. And we look at the Capitol building, and then the White House is there, and the Washington Monument. And I told some school kids not long ago, I said, Washington's a stage set for democracy. And then the minute I said that, I thought, well, I don't want to cheapen the enterprise or use too popular or vacuous a metaphor. So I immediately explained it, but it's real. It's designed to remind you that what you're doing is very important. You are put onto a stage with these props around you to help you realize that what you're doing is important and does have a significance and does have an obligation and does have a duty and does have an oath connected with it. And you must respect your position.
But a reverence for the Supreme Court doesn't mean, of course, that the justices are immune from criticism. Quite the contrary. And because of Justice Kennedy's frequent role as that fifth vote on the hot-button issues, he gets it from both sides, the right and the left, depending on the case. He's often sided with the conservative wing of the court on criminal law issues and states' rights and capital punishment. But he's also favored privacy over police power and access to abortion and the right of gay couples to marry. But Justice Kennedy says he doesn't concern himself with any controversy his positions have stirred up.
In part, we're so busy working on the next case, we can't worry about the last one. As I say again, you must be very confident that you're not deciding one way or the other because of popular opinion. The dynamic of the law is that it transcends or attempts to transcend the emotions of the time. That's the dynamic of the legal system. Most law professors and many commentators say that the judicial review, the idea that courts can set aside legislation, is anti-majoritarian or contra-majoritarian, so that a majority can't make its will binding on an injured minority. That's true in one sense, false in another. It may be true that when we set aside a particular congressional enactment or state law, which is an awful function, awful in the sense of powerful, it's true that we've, for the moment, may displease the majority. But if you look over time, if you ask what the American people and the majority of the American people want over time, over our history, they want judicial review. They want to make sure that the promises of the Constitution are honored, that the commitments we made basically over time with our ancestors are followed. And the Constitution defines the American people. You know, it's very odd. Americans have their self-definition, their self-identity, shaped by the Constitution. When we rebelled against England, the rest of the world said, what do these Americans want? What's the problem? And the Americans said, we want freedom. And the people in England and Europe said, freedom? Those are the freest people in the world on the other side of the Atlantic. They have all the property they need, all the land. They can pay taxes when they want, don't. What are they talking about, freedom? So then we had to send a fax back to them, an email, as to what our principles were, what the reason for this revolt was, what the reason was that we were committing our young people to confront the might of the British military. And the reason we gave was a legal one. The Declaration of Independence is basically an indictment of King George. And the Constitution is a formulation of what we think the principles of freedom are. And that's what defines America.
Justice Kennedy spends a good deal of his time teaching law students when he's not hearing arguments, deliberating, or writing a decision or a dissent. He's also taught the principles of the American legal system to judges around the world, even in Iraq, after the fall of Saddam Hussein. And he developed an educational exercise called Dialogue on Freedom that's been used by over 1 million high school students throughout the United States, all out of his devotion to the American ideal. It's that devotion that has made him an advocate of compromise in the best sense of the word.
It's essential. Sometimes people think compromise means squishy centrist. it doesn't. The whole idea of a democratic society is that there must be a consensus, and it's a consensus that should be based on rational dialogue. I'm not sure that mass politics and with modern communications has yet found a way to have a quiet, rational dialogue. I'm not quite sure we found the key to that. But we not only have to do that in our own society, we must not become a hostile, factious, divisive society. We must be a society that has a broad consensus on certain very fundamental values. And we must do that because after we build bridges of understanding with ourselves, we have to build bridges of understanding with the rest of the world. I was talking to some students around the turn of the century. I guess it would be 1999, I think. And some student raised his hand and said, what are the great issues of the next millennium or the next 100 years? It was something I should have had an answer for after dinner table conversation or something. And reflection. But I didn't. It caught me by surprise. So I came up with an answer. I said, we have the great challenge and the first duty to build bridges of understanding with the world of Islam. And I got more letters from that comment, this was on C-SPAN, than anything I've ever said. Thousands of letters saying, why aren't people saying that? And it struck me that there's a void there. We're in a struggle in which our security will depend on ideas. The idea of freedom, if accepted by most of the rest of the world, is our best security. And we must build bridges of understanding to explain the principles of freedom. And I'm not sure that we're doing a very good job at the moment. My major concern is that what I thought was the golden age of peace seems farther from our reach than I would have thought 10 years ago. My major concerns are that there is not an understanding and a commitment to the idea that the American constitutional system and the American idea of freedom has certain universal components that we have the duty, number one, to understand ourselves, and number two, to explain to the rest of the world, not at the point of a bayonet, that's sometimes necessary, but not at the point of a bayonet, but because we have a bond with all of humankind. And I don't think that we are looking far ahead enough in this respect, and I'm concerned about that nationalism, self-interest, will obscure the greatness of American traditions.
12 years after delivering these cautionary words in his 2005 interview, Justice Kennedy addressed young leaders at another Academy of Achievement summit, and this time his assessment was more foreboding.
We are reaching a crisis of civility. We are coming close to the brink of chaotic incivility. And that is one reason why we're here. We have to know and understand the dangers of this, because we have to be able to confront a revolution which is already undergoing and in which we are a part. It's the revolution of the cyber age. In my view, a revolution that may be equivalent to the Enlightenment. We were in Chautauqua a few years ago to see my granddaughter, who's a dancer, and they had the week was devoted to the theme of ancient Greece. So they said they put me on the panel about ancient Greece. Well, you know, Supreme Court, we know everything. So I couldn't think of it. I said, would we think the Greeks were free, and would they think we were free? And I said, now, you know, in case anybody for the National Enquirer is here, I understand Greek, men only, Athenian born, slavery, I get it. Would they think we were free? In Greece, the essence of freedom was a civic dialogue that was vibrant enough, rational enough, to plan the destiny of your country. And the destiny of that country was summed up in an oath that the Athenians took at the age of 18. I swear to the gods that I will participate in civic affairs and civic discussions to the end that Athens become more beautiful, more safe, and more free for our children than it is for us. Athens failed because they were unfaithful to that oath. When the freedom the Athenians wanted most was the freedom from responsibility, all of Athens ceased to be free. Every American, and I think all people in the free world, have a duty to preserve, protect, and defend their Constitution. But you can't preserve what you haven't studied. You can't protect what you've not discussed. You cannot defend what you do not know. And so, particularly as the young people pursue these magnificent careers in science and in the arts and in literature and in business, it's of essential importance for you to keep in mind that in this new age, you must develop a dialogue, a consensus, a civility, a kinship, a bond of freedom that will enable you to control the destiny of your country, the destiny of your culture, the destiny of your people, the destiny of your thought, the destiny of your religion, the destiny of your own dignity in an age which is changing so rapidly that it has taken us in directions we cannot see. The nature of a revolution is that you are involved in it long before you know its course. And we must have the capacity and the capacity and the will to control our destiny.
That's Anthony Kennedy, Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. I'd like to end on one last clip of Justice Kennedy from his 2005 interview, where he summed up in just a few words what he hopes his legacy will be.
As somebody who's decent, and honest, and fair, and who's absolutely committed to the proposition that freedom is America's gift to the rest of the world.
I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. What It Takes is made possible with funding from the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you, of course, for listening.